In October 2009, the Galleon Group, a hedge fund that managed more than $7 billion in assets, collapsed when its founder, Raj Rajaratnam, a Sri Lankan-born Wharton-educated billionaire, was arrested on charges of insider trading. The sensational case that followed pitted prosecutor Preet Bharara, an Indian immigrant, against the best and brightest of the South Asian business community in America, including Rajat Gupta, an Indian-American businessman and philanthropist who was the former managing director of the consulting firm McKinsey & Company and a board member of many corporations, including Goldman Sachs, Procter & Gamble, and American Airlines. In her book, The Billionaire's Apprentice, The Rise of the Indian-American Elite and the Fall of the Galleon Hedge Fund, Anita Raghavan chronicles the rise and fall of these men and the impact it's had on the South Asian community in America and around the world. It's published by Business Plus, and I'm very pleased that it brings Anita Raghavan to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you.
The Galleon Group scandal broke in 2009, about a year after the Madoff scandal, but it was unique because most of the players involved were of South Asian descent. How prominent a role do South Asians play in American business today?
Well, I mean, until very recently, Citigroup was headed by a South Asian and Indian named Vikram Pandit. Deutsche Bank, albeit a German bank, but with big operations in the U.S., has an Indian at the helm. So I think there are many examples, both at the highest levels and in the middle ranks and all through the system, of South Asians playing a very important part in the finance
even
business.
Though, as immigrants, they are relatively newcomers to this country. I'm thinking of some others, PepsiCo CEO Indira Nooyi. We have two governors, Bobby Jindal of Louisiana, Nimrata Nikki Randhawa Haley of South Carolina. And both of those governors are conservative Republicans. Have most of the Indian Americans who have risen so quickly in this country been politically conservative?
No, I don't think so, actually, Leonard. I think a lot of the Indians on Wall Street, and particularly the ones who came very early on to America, were Democrats, because they came at a time when America was just starting to throw off the shackles of its civil rights legacy, and it was hard for Indians early on to make their way in the United States, and they naturally allied with the Democrats.
But you say Indian Americans are twice blessed because they came after the civil rights struggles, at least had made it easier for them?
That's right. I mean, the first blessing, of course, of this generation of Indian Americans, the ones that you know today, was that they came in 19 they were all born after India won independence in 1947, and that opened up a whole array of educational opportunities in India. The IITs, which I think are known the world over now as a hothouse of Indian corporate talent, were started in the 1950s. So the Indians that came to America were highly educated to start.
But this is a legacy of the British rule.
Not the IITs. The IITs were created. It was a vision of Nehru's because he wanted an India that would be economically empowered to compete with the rest of the world. And we're seeing the fruits of it, of course, today.
The other thing is the Hart-Celler Act.
That's right.
Which was signed into law by President Lyndon Johnson in 1965, and it abolished national origins quota system that had been the U.S. immigration policy since the 1920s, replaced it with a preference system that focused on immigrant skills. So what effect did that have on South Asians who wanted to come to the United States?
Well, the South Asians that came to the United States essentially were the very they were the best and the brightest of South Asia. And one professor I spoke to for the book, you know, said the average Indian in the United States is 10,000 times more likely to have a PhD than the average Indian in India. So, you know, India, just like Mexico, has its own group of unwashed masses, but America actually got India's very rich cream.
I'm talking with Anita Raghavan, R-A-G-H-A-V-A-N. Her book, Billionaire's Apprentice, The Rise of the Indian-American Elite and the Fall of the Galleon Hedge Fund. It is published by Business Plus. This is WNYC, wnyc.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Now, you have been with The Wall Street Journal. You were the London bureau chief of Forbes magazine, and now writing largely for Forbes and the Times, the Deal Book articles. So you've been following these people as part of your regular beat.
That's right. That's right. And in a sense, I grew up with this generation of Indians. I was at the Wall Street Journal in 1994, and I remember reading about Rajat Gupta being named to the helm of McKinsey. And you know, of course, it was really in the 80s, at the beginning of the 80s, we saw Indians coming in great masses to the U.S., and particularly in the finance industry.
Well, two men at the center of the Galleon scandal, Rajaratnam and Rajat Gupta, both came here to attend business schools, didn't they?
That's right. That's right. Rajaratnam came in the early 80s. Rajat Gupta came a decade earlier in 1971. And as I discuss in the book, you know, The Billionaire's Apprentice, you know, the changes in the United States in the 10 years were phenomenal. By the time Rajaratnam came in the early 80s, Wall Street was on the cusp of a boom, and there was real demand for South Asians who had the kinds of skills he did.
Had they come from elite families?
Rajaratnam certainly did. Rajat Gupta, and again, this is very much laid out in the book, came from a very humble background, but had his family was steeped in education. They were all intellectuals. So they were rich in education, poor in wealth.
Rajat Gupta graduated from Harvard Business School in 1973, and then began working at the at McKinsey and Company. What did he do when he first started working there?
He was a junior consultant. He was an associate like everyone else at McKinsey. His early years were a bit of a struggle. Having grown up in the Indian educational system, he was accustomed to being less outspoken than the average American, and he was often chided for being too quiet in team meetings. But clearly, by the 80s, he picked up.
And 21 years after he joined the firm, he was elected the first McKinsey managing director to be born outside of the United States, and then was reelected twice in 97 and 2000. Was this a big deal for the South Asian community in the United States and back home as well?
Absolutely. You know, I think we all sit here today and we see how many South Asians are in positions of power. You named a few, Leonard, Indra Nooyi, Vikram Pandit. But in 1994, when Rajat Gupta was first elected to the helm of McKinsey, he really did break a glass ceiling. Before that time, you know, there was the CEO of Ethan Allen, and there was Bhaskar Menon, who was CEO of EMI, which was really an English-British company. But in terms of the American corporate aristocracy, there had not been an Indian American at the top.
So Mr. Gupta mentors another Indian immigrant named Anil Kumar. Was this the normal process? So let's bring more people up, more of our own?
I certainly think during the 90s at McKinsey, you had a vast influx of Indians coming into the firm. I hear today, you know, the banking practice is something like 90% Indian. So, you know, just like every other immigrant group, I think the Indians brought their kin.
They also sent things abroad. During their time together at McKinsey, Mr. Gupta and Mr. Kumar are credited with creating the idea of outsourcing white-collar service jobs to India.
That's right.
So they're the ones who are to blame.
Well, they certainly, you know, played a big role in the exporting of high-end white-collar jobs, what's known as, you know, knowledge process outsourcing, legal transcription, medical transcription. It was a great boon for India because those are the really well-paying jobs and obviously perhaps less of a boon for America.
Well, while he was managing director of McKinsey, Mr. Gupta opened offices in 23 new countries. He doubled its consultant base, increased revenue 280% to $3.4 billion. Did the American business community react to his success?
Absolutely. Rajat Gupta, by the time he left the helm of McKinsey, was part of the American corporate establishment. He was friends with Hank Paulson. He mingled with Henry Kravis. He knew Bill Gates through his charitable events. He was an assimilated Indian.
But not everybody at McKinsey appreciated what he was doing. They felt he was going against their founding principles.
That's right. I think by his last term, there was a feeling that McKinsey had moved away from its value-based legacy, the legacy that was handed down by Marvin Bower, that there was too much focus on profits, on revenues. And he did lose some affection there.
He also kind of turned McKinsey from a consulting firm into a venture capital firm.
Not a bit, but he didn't go as far as some of his peers. He certainly you know, in the heady times of the late 1990s, when a lot of McKinsey associates were leaving to join technology firms, Rajat Gupta and his partners decided to allow the firm, in selected cases, to accept equity from technology companies they were working for. And that was a great departure from McKinsey practice in the past.
Enron also became closely identified with McKinsey. And it collapsed while Mr. Gupta was managing director.
That's right.
Were they implicated in the scandal?
Not at all. And I think they were very concerned about whether they would be implicated. I think soon after Enron collapsed, they certainly sent their people out to see if there was any issue for them, and there wasn't.
But you wound up interviewing Jeffrey Skilling.
That's right.
The former Enron CEO. You went to prison to talk to him?
I didn't. I actually had a series of email interviews with him. I found him very eloquent. He was a great historian of McKinsey. He had been at the firm at the same time as Rajat in the 70s when the firm had gone through a rather rough spell. And I found him a wonderful and articulate, spokesman for the company.
He'd been a former partner at McKinsey. Does he excuse what Enron did?
He wouldn't talk about Enron because obviously he was in the midst of his appeal.
And Mr. Gupta was involved in a number of other corporations: Goldman Sachs, Procter & Gamble, American Airlines. Is there something incestuous about this whole practice of somebody who is in a place like McKinsey and then on the boards of all these other places that they do business with?
Well, you're only allowed to go on boards after you step down from McKinsey. That's one of McKinsey's principles. Is there something incestuous? Well, here's the challenge, Leonard. You need people who understand these businesses to sit on boards, because otherwise you probably couldn't sift through the businesses. So I think you'll always have that as part of the landscape.
I guess I was thinking, was he privileged to confidential information as a result of his involvement?
Well, again, remember, he went on these boards after he stepped down from McKinsey. And so, yes, of course, he was privy to confidential information, just like you and I would be privy if we sat on boards. So it's no different.
And he's also been involved in nonprofits: the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation. Has he been seen as a generous donor?
I think he's been seen as a generous advocate of the charities that he was involved in. And I think this might have been part of the frustration, part of what led him to get into business with Rajaratnam. He was often in a position of collecting checks from people rather than writing them out himself.
We will get to Rajaratnam after we take a little break. My guest is Anita Raghavan. Her book, The Billionaire's Apprentice, The Rise of the Indian American Elite and the Fall of the Galleon Hedge Fund. It is published by Business Plus. Stay with us. We are back with Anita Raghavan. Her book, Billionaire's Apprentice, The Rise of the Indian American Elite and the Fall of the Galleon Hedge Fund. It's published by Business Plus. So a couple of years ago, 2011, Raj Rajaratnam was convicted of 14 counts of conspiracy and securities fraud, received an 11-year prison sentence, the longest ever given in the United States for insider trading. Was the government trying to make an example of him, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Traders' memories are short. The last time we had a big insider trading case was, of course, when Giuliani in the late 80s arrested a bunch of Wall Streeters and charged them with insider trading. And since then, the practice has crept back into Wall Street's culture, and the government wanted to make sure that people learned a lesson.
And then the prosecuting attorney for the case was Preet Bharara. Do you think that he took this case personally because it involves so many South Asians?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the case was well underway before he got the job in August 2009. It was an investigation that dated back to 2006. And so by the time he came, I mean, the only thing he could have done was stop it, and that would have caused more eyebrows raised than anything else.
It was a unique case in many ways, from the long prison sentence to the use of wiretaps for the first time in a case involving insider trading. How did the investigators get a judge to give them permission to do those wiretaps?
They just wrote one of these turgid legal documents and went before a judge in an ex parte proceeding and convinced him that there was no other way they could root out insider trading at Galleon.
Well, we have heard that one of the reasons that we haven't seen more prosecutions as a result of all of the hanky-panky and the banks is because it's hard to prove these cases. Did the wiretaps make it easier in this case?
Absolutely. As an Indian myself, I often get asked the question, were Indians targeted in this investigation? And, you know, I have to say, I don't think so. It was just that the evidence was so compelling because of the wiretaps. Now, if you want to link a CEO to mortgage fraud, it's a lot harder to do. There are many layers that you have to penetrate.
Were they openly discussing insider trading on the phone?
Absolutely. You know, and not only were they discussing insider trading, they were in many cases, as I say in my book, they were showing how to obstruct justice, how to cover up their tracks.
How did the Securities and Exchange Commission first become aware that something wasn't right at Galleon?
Well, a lawyer who worked for a Wall Street firm actually came in one dull day in August 2006 and told them about an obscure practice called cherry picking at a hedge fund that belonged to Raj's brother, Rengan. And
that's a Sedna Cap.
That's at Sedna Capital. And they found out that they found much more than cherry picking. They found insider trading. And that's what led them to Raj.
So Raj was telling his brother what to buy?
I think the information flow worked both ways.
And how were they acquiring the information?
From contacts that they had in the business community. A number of them were South Asian business contacts. Whenever the investigators were looking through Raj's Rolodex, if there was a South Asian name, I think they double-starred.
A name like Rumi Khan.
Exactly.
She was a key witness against Mr. Rajaratnam. How did she first come to the attention of the investigators? Simply because she had an Indian-sounding name?
No, there was a very important instant message that they discovered that Rumi Khan sent to Raj Rajaratnam, and he was clearly looking for some guidance on earnings for a technology company, and she said, "Wait till I get guidance." And that, of course, stood out to them.
In the late 1990s, she had been fired from her job at Intel after she was caught leaking confidential information. The story is really interesting. Intel actually installed cameras over the fax machines because they were suspicious of her?
That's right. That's one of the whole investigation that Intel had into Rumi Khan is one of the things that I devote quite a lot of time to in the book. And they not only had fax machines over the fax cameras over the fax machines, but they also had cameras over her desk, and they had an overhead camera so they could capture what she was faxing, and so that they could, you know, if they needed to, show that it was actually numbers.
And then somebody else discovered the camera and got really upset, said, "Hey, we have Big Brother is watching us," not realizing that it was focused solely on Rumi Khan.
Right.
What kind of information was she supplying, and how was she getting it?
She was getting it through her job as a marketing manager at Intel, and it was revenue numbers for processors they were selling. That she was just at first she would call Roger Rutnam and convey these numbers over the phone, but I guess over time she got more comfortable and started faxing them.
And then after she left Intel, she worked for Roger Rutnam at Galien, but then she was asked to leave.
That's right. She wanted to trade in her personal account, and in the late 90s, it was actually very lucrative for her. She, at one point in 1999-2000, was worth $40 million on paper. Now, of course, all of that money dissolved into nothing, and 7 years later, she was looking for a job from Raj because she was hard up for cash, but that's another story.
And now, circling around, the star witness for the prosecution at Roger Rutnam's trial was Mr. Kumar, the man who had been mentored by Mr. Gupta at McKinsey.
Mm-hmm.
How did Kumar and Roger Rutnam first meet?
They first met at Wharton, actually. They were both in the class of 1981, and they weren't particularly good friends. They didn't even like each other. I think Raj thought of Kumar as sort of a snooty, arrogant Indian, and Kumar looked with some great disdain upon Raj, who he considered to be frivolous and, you know, a big talker. And they didn't really keep in touch after they left Wharton. But as Raj became more prominent in the technology space, Kumar, who was very ambitious, started giving him some time.
And then started giving him some information.
That's right.
Now, not everybody is willing to cross that line.
That's right. Anil Kumar, to me, was one of the most interesting characters, because if you had talked to his high school friends, they would have said he was the least likely person to engage in this sort of behavior. He was a real straight arrow. And yet he was so driven by this desire to be one of the big guys. He finally fell into bed with Roger Rutnam and gave him information.
And was being given money for it?
That's right.
Was Mr. Gupta connected in some way to this insider trading ring?
I don't think Gupta knew of the Kumar-Roger Rutnam ring, and nor did Kumar know that Gupta was giving information to Roger Rutnam. I think these were two separate arrangements. But Gupta, at some point around 2006, started feeding information to Roger Rutnam.
And why would he? It was such a giant success.
I think that, it's a funny thing. I think it's a bright lights, big city phenomenon. Gupta, for most of his career, had worked in the hinterlands, you know, Scandinavia, Chicago. In the late 90s, he comes to the Northeast, and he's suddenly thrust into a new world where the money is so much bigger, and he's mingling with people like Henry Kravis and Hank Paulson, people who really can bankroll some of the charitable causes that he wants to participate in.
He's also going to the White House. He's traveling in the big leagues now.
That's right. And I think he had this deep insecurity. He wanted to be part of that group, and he ultimately, you know, decided to join it through illegitimate means.
So in May 2012, a year after Mr. Rajaratnam was convicted of 14 counts of securities fraud and conspiracy and sentenced to 11 years in prison, Mr. Gupta was convicted on 4 of 6 counts of conspiracy and securities fraud. Was he given a prison sentence as well?
He was. He was sentenced to 2 years, and that's something he's currently appealing.
So he's still out?
He's still out.
And what's the status of the appeal?
The appeal was heard on May 21st, and judging by the questions the appeals judges asked, it didn't seem like they were sympathetic to his argument, but I don't think we'll hear any answer on the appeal until the Rajaratnam appeal on the wiretaps is sorted out.
Has he also been caught on the wiretaps, Mr. Gupta?
Yes, there was one call. It was not a call where he was passing what's known as material in non-public information to Rajaratnam, but he was caught on this call saying something that I thought was far more damning. Rajaratnam confides in Gupta. He tells him, you know, I'm paying your colleague at McKinsey, you know, $1 million a year offshore. And Gupta responds, yeah, I think you're being very generous. And he's acquiescing, you know, in a colleague doing something that ran so counter to McKinsey's principles.
A lot of people assume that insider trading is just the norm on Wall Street. Is this a unique situation?
I don't think it's a unique situation. I think it probably happens less often today than it did in 2008 and 2009 before these prosecutions. But, you know, I think it's a common feature of the Wall Street landscape. And, you know, the recent prosecutions will tamp it down, but it will come back.
Well, there's just last month, Steve A. Cohen, the manager of a hedge fund called SAC Capital?
That's right.
Advisors received a subpoena to appear before a grand jury in their ongoing insider trading investigations. Are they related in any ways to what we saw with Galleon?
Well, I think certainly SAC first came onto regulators' radar back in 2006 when they were investigating Galleon and investigating Sedna, because Rengan Rajaratnam, who founded Sedna, was seen as exchanging information with an SAC trader. And you know, whenever the government tries to build these cases, they're always looking for the best in to a case. And while there were signs of possible wrongdoing at SAC Capital in 2006, there was no real good end to the case, and I think they found a better end many years later.
What about the other people we've been talking about? Rumi Khan, Rengan Rajaratnam, are they also going to jail? Have they also been convicted?
Rumi is going to go to jail very shortly. I believe it's in about a week.
Mr. Kumar
managed to escape jail because, of course, he cooperated with the government. He got 2 years probation. And generally, if you tell on your friends, it seems to give you a free pass. And Rengan was indicted just this spring on charges of insider trading, many of the same stocks that his brother Raj was caught exchanging information on.
Now, you'll be speaking at the Asia Society tomorrow night at 6:30.
That's right.
And I guess this is a bigger story, as big a story as it is on Wall Street. It's even a bigger story on the South Asian community.
That's right.
Many of these people were known by many of the South Asians who were living in New York.
Yes, I mean, I think for most of their careers, most of these people were role models for the South Asians living in New York, and they looked up to them. And so this is a big blemish on the community.
The event at the Asia Society tomorrow night is at 6:30. It's at Park Avenue and 70th Street. And if you want more information about it, tickets, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. The book is Billionaire's Apprentice, The Rise of the Indian American Elite and the Fall of the Galleon Hedge Fund. It's published by Business Plus. And my great thanks to Anita Raghavan for being our guest today.
Thank you, Leonard.